sister to get in touch. That's all it amounts to. Yeah, all right. I get touchy now and then. I've been under a lot of pressure, and I don't mean to take it out on you. She'll probably call at some point, and I'll give her your name and number, okay? Great, I'd appreciate that. I held out my hand, and she shook it briefly. Her fingers were dry and cold. It's been nice talking to you, I said.
You too, she replied.
I hesitated, glancing back at her. If you do move into a motel, how will Elaine know where to reach you?
The smirk was back, but there was something else in her eyes.
How about I leave a forwarding address with Makowski, my friendly building manager downstairs? That way you'll know how to reach me, too.
Will that do the trick?
Probably so. Thanks much.
Chapter 4
I moved off toward the stairs. I could feel her eyes on my back, and then I heard the door close. I continued on down to the parking lot and got in my car and drove off. I wanted to talk to Mrs. Ochsner in the next apartment, but I thought it was better to wait. Something about Pat Usher bothered me. It was not just the fact that some of what she'd told me was untrue. I'm a born liar myself, and I know how it's done.
You stick as close to the truth as you can. You pretend to volunteer a few bits of information, but the facts are all carefully selected for effect.
Pat's problem was that she was having to wing far too much, and she'd started to embroider where she should have kept her mouth shut. That business about Elaine Bolt picking her up in Fort Lauderdale in a rented white Cutlass was crap. Elaine didn't drive. Tilly had told me that. At the moment, I couldn't figure out why Pat had lied about it, but it must have been significant. What really bothered me about her was that she had no class, and it struck me as odd that Elaine Bolt had chosen her for a friend. From what Tilly and Beverly told me, I had the feeling Elaine was a bit of a snob, and Pat Usher didn't seem quite glossy enough to satisfy. I found a drugstore half a block away and bought two packs of index cards so I could make some notes, and then I put in a call to Mrs. Ochsner in 317. Finally, she picked up.
Hello?
I identified myself and told her where I was. I've just been up there talking to Pat Usher, and I don't want her to know that I'm talking to you. Is there some way we can get together?
Well, what fun, Mrs. Ochsner said. What shall we do? I could take the elevator down to the laundry room. It's right near the parking lot, you know, and you could pick me up.
Let's do that, I said. I'll swing by in 10 minutes.
Make it 15. I'm slower than you think.
The woman whom I helped into the front seat of the car had hobbled out of the laundry room with a cane. She was small, with a dowager's hump the size of a backpack, and off-white hair that stood out around her head like dandelion fuzz. Her face was as soft and withered as an apple doll, and arthritis had twisted her hands into grotesque shapes, as though she intended to make geese heads in shadow on the wall. She was wearing a house dress that seemed to hang on her bony frame, and her ankles were wrapped in ace bandages. She had two garments over her left arm.
"I want to drop these off at the cleaners," she said. "You can run them in. I want to stop by the market, too. I'm out of my cereal and half and half."
Her manner was energetic, her voice wavering but excited. I went around to my side of the car and got in. I started the car, glancing at the third floor to make sure Pat Usher wasn't standing there watching us. I pulled out. Mrs. Ochsner peered at me avidly.
"You don't look at all like you sounded on the phone," she said. "I thought you'd be blonde with blue eyes." "What are they, gray?"
"Hazel," I said. I lowered my sunglasses so she could see for herself. "Where's the cleaners from here?"
"Right next door to that drugstore you telephoned from. What do you call that haircut?"
I glanced at myself in the rearview mirror. "I guess I don't call it anything. I do that myself with nail scissors every 6 weeks." I keep my hair short because I don't like to fool with it.
Why? Do you think it looks bad?
I don't know yet. It probably suits, but I don't know you well enough to say.
What about me? Do I look like I sound?
I glanced over at her.
You sound like a hellraiser on the phone.
I was when I was your age.
Now I have to be careful I'm not just written off as a crank like Ida. All my dear friends died, and I got stuck with the crabby ones. What kind of luck are you having with Elaine?
Not a lot. Pat Usher says she was actually in Boca for a couple of days and then took off again.
No, she wasn't.
Are you sure?
Of course I am. She always knocked on the wall when she got in. It was like a little code. She's been doing it for years. She'd come over within the hour and make arrangements to play bridge with us because she knew how much it meant.
I parked in front of the cleaners and picked up the two dresses she'd placed over the seat.
I'll be right back, I said.
I took care of both errands while Mrs. Oxner waited, and then we sat in the car and talked. I filled her in on my conversation with Pat Usher.
What do you think of her? I asked.
She's too aggressive, Mrs. Oxner said. She tried to cultivate me at first, you know. Sometimes I'd sit out on the balcony in the sun, and she'd talk to me. She always had that sooty smell people get when they smoke too much.
What did you talk about?
Well, it wasn't culture, I'll tell you that. She talked about food most of the time, but I never saw her put anything in her mouth except cigarettes and Fresca. She drank pop incessantly, and that mouth of hers flapped all the time. So self-centered. I don't believe she ever asked me one word about myself. It simply never occurred to her. I was bored to death, of course, and began to avoid her whenever I could. Now she's rude because she knows I disapprove of her. Insecure people have a special sensitivity for anything that finally confirms their own low opinion of themselves.
Did she mention Elaine?
Oh, yes. She said Elaine was off on a trip, which struck me as odd. I'd never known her to come down here only to go someplace else. What would be the point?
Can you tell me who else Elaine might have kept in touch with? Any other friends or relatives down here?
End of Disc 1. Disc 2.
Can you tell me who else Elaine might have kept in touch with? Any other friends or relatives down here?
I'll have to think about that. I don't know of anyone offhand. I assume that most of her good friends are in California, since that's where she lives most of the time.
We talked on for a while, but mostly about other things. At 11:15, I thanked her and took her back to the parking lot, gave her my business card so she could call me if she needed to, and then watched her hobble to the elevator. Her gait was irregular, like a marionette's being worked from above by strings. She waved to me with her cane, and I waved back. She hadn't told me much, but I was hoping she'd be able to report on what was happening here after I flew back. I drove out to the beach then, and sat in the parking lot with my index cards, making notes of everything I could remember about my search to this point. It took an hour, and my hand was cramped, but I needed to get it down while the details were fresh. When I finished, I took my shoes off and locked the car, walking the beach. It was too hot to jog, and the lack of sleep had left me torpid anyway. The breeze coming in off the ocean was dense with the smell of salt. The surf seemed to roll in at half speed, and there were no whitecaps. The ocean was a luminous blue, and the sand was littered with exotic shells. All I'd ever seen on the California beaches were tangles of kelp and occasional Coke bottle bottoms worn smooth by the sea. I longed to stretch out on the beach and nap in the hot sun, but I had to be on my way. I ate lunch at a roadside stand built of pink cinder block while a radio station blared out Spanish language programs as foreign to me as the food. I feasted on black bean soup and a bolsa, a sort of pouch made of pastry holding a spicy ground meat. By 4 o'clock that afternoon, I was on a plane headed for California. I'd been in Florida for less than 12 hours, and I wondered if I was any closer to finding Elaine Bolt. It was possible that Pat Usher was being straight with me when she claimed Elaine was in Sarasota, but I doubted it. In any event, I was anxious to get home, and I slept like the dead until the plane reached Lax. When I got to the office at 9 the next morning, I filled out a routine form for the driver's license records at the Department of Motor Vehicles in Tallahassee, Florida, and a second form for Sacramento, on the off chance that Elaine might have been issued a driver's license in her own name sometime in the last 6 months. I also sent similar requests to the vehicle registration records in both places, not so much with the expectation of the inquiries paying off, but just to cover my bets. I stuck all four envelopes in my outbox, and then I pulled out the phone book and started checking addresses for travel agents located within walking distance of Elaine's condominium. I was hoping to establish her travel arrangements and find out if a plane ticket had been used. So far, I had only Pat Usher's word that Elaine had ever arrived in Miami. Maybe she never even reached the airport in Santa Teresa, or maybe she got off the plane at some point en route. In any event, I was going to have to check it out item by item. I felt as if I were on an assembly line inspecting reality with a jeweler's loop. There's no place in a PI's life for impatience, faint-heartedness, or sloppiness. I understand the same qualifications apply for housewives. Most of my investigations proceed just like this. Endless notes, endless sources checked and rechecked, pursuing leads that sometimes go no place. Usually I start in the same place, plodding along methodically, never knowing at first what might be significant. It's all detail, facts accumulated painstakingly. It's hard to remain anonymous these days. Information is available on just about anyone. Credit files on microfiche, service records, lawsuits, marriages, divorces, wills, births, deaths, licenses, permits, vehicles registered. If you want to remain invisible, pay cash for everything, and if you err, don't get caught. Otherwise, any good PI, or even a curious and persistent private citizen, can find you out. It amazes me that the average person isn't more paranoid. Most of our personal data is a matter of public record. All you have to know is how to look it up. What your state and city government don't have on file, your next-door neighbor will usually share without so much as a dollar changing hands. If there was no way to get a line on Elaine Bolt directly, I'd try an oblique approach. She'd left for Boca 2 weeks early, traveling at night, which, according to Tilly, was something she didn't like to do. She'd told Tilly she was ill, leaving town on doctor's orders. But at this point, there was no verification of that claim. Elaine might have lied to Tilly. Tilly might be lying to me. For all I knew, Elaine had left the country, planting Pat Usher behind her to promulgate the notion that she was in Sarasota instead. I hadn't any idea why she'd do such a thing, but then I had a lot of ground to cover yet. Having narrowed the list of travel agencies to 6 possibilities, I put in a call to Beverly Danziger and filled her in on my excursion to Florida. I wanted to bring her up to date, even though the trip hadn't netted me much. I also had a couple of questions for her. "What about family?" I asked. "Are your parents alive?" "Oh, they've both been gone for years. We were never a close-knit family in the first place. I don't even think there were uncles or cousins she'd kept in touch with."
"What about jobs? What sort of work has she done?"
Beverly laughed at that. "You must not have a clear sense of Elaine quite yet. Elaine never lifted a finger in her life."
"But she does have a Social Security card," I said. "If she's worked at all, it gives me one more avenue to pursue. For all we know, she's waiting table someplace for a lark."
"Well, I don't think she's ever had a job, and if she did, it's not something she'd ever do again," Beverly said primly. "Elaine was spoiled. She felt she should be handed everything. And what she wasn't handed, she took right out from under your nose anyway." I really wasn't much in the mood to listen to Beverly unload past grievances. "Look, let's skip to the bottom line here. I think we ought to file a missing persons report. That way we can open up the scope of this thing.
It should also eliminate some possibilities, and believe me, at this point, everything helps.
The silence was so complete, I thought she'd hung up on me.
Hello?
No, I'm here, she said. I just don't understand why you want to talk to the police, of all people.
Because it's the next logical step. She may well be somewhere in Florida, but suppose she's not. At the moment, we only have Pat Usher's word for that. Why not get some broad-scale coverage? Let the cops put out an APB. Let the Boca Raton PD get some sort of inquiry routed through Sarasota and see what they come up with. They can circulate a description through the state and local police down there and at least determine that she's not ill or dead or under arrest.
Dead?
Hey, I'm sorry. I know it sounds alarming, and it may be nothing like that, but the cops will have access to information I just can't get.
I don't believe this. I just wanted her signature. I hired you because I thought it would be the quickest way to find her. I don't think it's really a police matter. I mean, I simply don't want you to do that.
All right. What then? You can't ask me to find your sister for you and then start cutting off lines of inquiry.
I don't see why not, if I don't think it's appropriate. I don't see why you can't just let it go at this.
This time I was silent, wondering at the nature of her uneasiness. Beverly, did I miss something here? Are you telling me to drop it?
Well, I don't know. Let me think about it, and I'll call you back. I just didn't think it would be a problem, and I'm not sure I want you to go on with this. Maybe Mr. Wender can proceed without her. Maybe he can find some loophole that will let him hold out only her portion of the estate until she turns up.
You didn't seem to feel that way 2 days ago, I said.
Maybe I made a mistake, she said. Let's just don't worry about it right now, okay? I'll be in touch if I want you to go on with it. In the meantime, why don't you send me a report and an itemized bill of some kind? I'll have to talk to my husband about what to do from here.
All right, I said with puzzlement. But I have to tell you I'm worried.
Well, don't be, she said, and the phone clicked in my ear.
I stared at the receiver.
Now what was all that about? Her anxiety had been unmistakable, but I couldn't ignore the message. She hadn't fired me outright, but she'd put me on hold, and I wasn't technically supposed to proceed without her instructions to do so. Reluctantly, I went back through my index cards and typed up a report. I was stalling for time, and I knew it, but I wasn't ready to let go. I put a carbon in my files and slipped the original in an envelope, which I addressed to Beverly, enclosing an itemization of my expenses to that point. Beyond the $750 retainer she'd given me, she'd authorized an additional $250 for a total not to exceed $1,000 without further written notice, which was contractual double talk for the fact that so far we were covered. With the plane fare, the rental car, long-distance calls, and approximately 30 hours of my time, the charges came to $996 plus change. She owed me $246. I suspected she'd pay me off and wash her hands of it. My guess was that she'd enjoyed hiring a detective, officiously stirring up trouble for Elaine, who'd annoyed her by not signing on the dotted line as she'd been asked. Now, suddenly, she must have realized that she'd opened up a big can of worms. I locked up the office and dropped the report in a mailbox on my way home. Elaine Bolt was still among the missing, and that didn't sit well with me. Chapter 5. My phone rang at 2:08 a.m. I picked up the receiver automatically, my brain still blank with sleep.
Kinsey Milhone.
The voice was male, and the tone was neutral, like someone reading at random from a telephone book. Somehow I knew it was a cop. They all sound like that.
Yes, who's this? Miss Milhone, this is Patrolman Benedict of the Santa Teresa Police Department. We've been called on a 594 at 2097 Via Madrina, Apartment 1, and a Mrs. Tilly Allberg is asking for you. Would it be possible for you to lend some assistance? We have a policewoman with her, but she's asked for you specifically, and we'd appreciate it if you could respond. I raised up on one elbow, a few brain cells switching to ignition. What's a 594? I said. Malicious mischief? Yes, ma'am. It was clear Patrolman Benedict didn't want to risk anything by rushing right in with a lot of facts. Is Tilly okay? I asked. Yes, ma'am. She's unharmed, but she's upset. We don't mean to disturb you, but the lieutenant okayed us to get in touch. I'll be there in 5 minutes, I said, and hung up. I pushed the quilt back and grabbed for my jeans and sweatshirt, pulling on boots without ever getting up off the couch. I usually sleep naked in a fold of quilt because it's so much easier than opening the sofa bed. I went into the bathroom, brushed my teeth, and splashed water on my face, combing my unruly hair with my fingers as I snatched up my keys and moved to the car. I was wide awake by now, wondering what kind of 594 we were talking about. Tilly Ahlberg was clearly not the perpetrator, or she'd have called an attorney instead. The night air was cold, and the fog had rolled in off the beach and halfway across town, filling the empty streets with a fine mist. Stoplights blinked dutifully from red to green to red again, but there was no traffic, and I ran the lights every chance I got. There was a black and white parked out in front of 2097, and the lights in Tilly's ground floor apartment were all on, but things seemed quiet. No flashing red lights, no neighbors gathered on the sidewalk. I announced myself on the intercom, and somebody buzzed me in. I pushed through the door to the right of the elevator and moved quickly down the corridor to Tilly's apartment at the end. Several people in robes and pajamas stood in the hall near the door, but a patrolman in uniform was encouraging them to go on back to bed. When he spotted me, he approached, hands on his hips as though he didn't know what else to do with them. He looked like he'd probably still be asked for his ID when he ordered a drink, but up close I could see signs of age, fine lines near his eyes. A slight loosening of the taut skin along his jaw. His eyes were old, and I knew he'd already seen more of the human condition than he could assimilate. I held out my hand. "Are you Benedict?" "Yes, ma'am," he said, shaking hands with me. "You're Miss Milhone, I take it. Nice to meet you. We appreciate this." His grip was firm, but brief. He nodded toward the door to Tilly's apartment, which stood ajar. "You can go on in if you want. Officer Redfern is with her, taking down particulars." I thanked him and moved into the apartment, glancing to my right. The living room looked like something left in the path of a tornado. I stopped and stared for a moment. Vandalism in a place like this? I moved into the kitchen. Tilly was sitting at the table with her hands tucked between her knees, the freckles standing out on her pale face like red pepper flakes. A uniformed policewoman, maybe 40 years old, was seated at the table taking notes. She had short-cropped blonde hair and a birthmark like a patch of rose petals on one cheek. Her name tag identified her as Isabel Redfern, and she talked to Tilly in low, earnest tones, like someone trying to persuade a flyer not to leap off a bridge. When Tilly caught sight of me, tears spilled out of her eyes and she began to shake, as though my appearance were tacit permission to fall apart. I knelt down beside her, taking her hands. "Hey, it's okay," I said. "What's going on?" She tried to speak, but nothing came out at first except a wheezing sound like someone stepping on a rubber duck. Finally, she managed to choke out a response.
"Someone broke in. I woke up and saw this woman standing in the door to my room. My God, I thought my heart would stop. I couldn't even move, I was so terrified. And then she started... It was like this hissing sound, and she ran in the living room and started tearing everything up."
Tilly put a handkerchief over her mouth and nose, closing her eyes. Officer Redfern and I exchanged a look. Bizarre stuff. I put my arm around Tilly's shoulders, giving her a little shake. "Come on, Tilly," I said. "It's over now, and you're safe."
"I was so scared. I was so scared. I thought she was going to kill me. She was like a maniac, like a totally crazy person, panting and hissing and crashing around. I slammed the bedroom door shut and locked it and then dialed 911. Next thing I knew, it got quiet, but I didn't open up the door until the police got here.
That's great. You did great. Look, I know you were scared, but you did it just right, and now it's okay.
The policewoman leaned forward.
Did you get a look at this woman?
Tilly shook her head, beginning to shake again. This time the policewoman took Tilly's hands.
Take a couple of deep breaths. Just relax. It's over now and everything's fine. Breathe deeply. Come on. Do you have any tranquilizers on hand or alcohol of some kind?
I got up and moved over to the kitchen cabinets, opening doors at random, but there didn't seem to be any liquor at all. I found a bottle of vanilla extract and poured the contents into a jelly glass. Tilly downed it without even looking. She began to breathe deeply, calming herself.
I never saw her before in my life, she said in somewhat more ordered tones. She was crazy, a lunatic. I don't even know how she got in.
She paused. The air smelled like cookies. The policewoman looked up from her notes.
Mrs. Ahlberg, there was no sign of forced entry. It had to be someone who had a key. Have you given a key to anyone in the past? Maybe someone who was house-sitting, someone who watered your plants when you were away?
At first Tilly shook her head, and then she stopped and shot a look at me, her eyes filled with sudden alarm.
Elaine, she's the only one who ever had one.
She turned to the policewoman.
My neighbor in the apartment right above me. I gave her a key last fall when I took a little trip to San Diego.
I took over then, filling in the rest. Elaine's apparent disappearance and her sister's hiring me. Officer Redfern got up.
Hold on. I want Benedict to hear this.
It was 3:30 in the morning by the time Redfern and Benedict were finished, and Tilly was exhausted. They asked her to come down to the station later that morning to sign a statement, and in the meantime I said I'd stay with her until she had herself under control again. When the cops finally left, Tilly and I sat and stared at each other wearily.
"Could it have been Elaine?" I asked.
"I don't know," she said. "I don't think so. But it was dark, and I wasn't thinking straight."
"What about her sister? Did you ever meet Beverly Danziger? Or a woman named Pat Usher?"
Tilly shook her head mutely. Her face was still as pale as a dinner plate, and there were dark circles under her eyes. She anchored her hands between her knees again, tension humming through her like a wind across guitar strings. I moved into the living room and surveyed the damage more closely. The big glass-fronted secretary had been tipped over and lay face down on the coffee table, which looked to have collapsed on impact. The couch had been slashed, the foam hanging out now like pale flesh. Drapes were torn down. Windows had been broken, lamps and magazines and flower pots flung together in a heap of pottery shards and water and paper pulp. This was what insanity looked like when it was on the loose. That or unbridled rage, I thought. This had to be connected to Elaine's disappearance. There was no way I'd believe it was an independent event, coincidental to my search for her. I wondered if there was a way to find out where Beverly Danziger had been tonight. With her porcelain good looks and her blinking china blue eyes, it was hard to picture her loping around all Looney Tunes, but how did I know for sure? Maybe she'd driven up to Santa Teresa the first time on an institutional pass. I tried to imagine what it would be like to wake in the dead of night to some hissing female on the rampage. An involuntary shiver took me, and I went back into the kitchen. Tilly hadn't moved, but her eyes came up to my face with a look of dependency.
"Let's get it cleaned up," I said. "We're neither of us going to sleep anyway, and you shouldn't have to do this by yourself. Where do you keep your dustpan and broom?"
She pointed to the utility room, and then with a sigh she got to her feet and we went to work.
When order had been restored, I told Tilly I wanted the key to Elaine's apartment.
What for?
She asked apprehensively. I want to check it out. Maybe she's up there.
I'll come with you, she volunteered promptly.
I wondered vaguely if she was going to follow me around for life, like Yogi Bear and Boo Boo. Still, I gave her a quick hug and told her to wait a minute while I made a quick trip to my VW. She shook her head and followed me outside. I took my semi-automatic out of the glove compartment, hefting it in my hand. It was a nondescript 32 with a cross-hatched ivory grip and a clip that would hold 8 rounds. The life of a private eye is short on gun battles, long on basic research. But there are times when a ballpoint pen just doesn't get it. I had visions of some deranged female flying out of the darkness at me like a bat. A 32 may not have much stopping power, but it can sure slow you down. I wedged the gun in the back of my jeans and headed back to the elevator with Tilly at my heels.
I thought it was against the law to carry a concealed weapon like that, she said uneasily.
That's why I have a permit, I said.
But I always heard handguns were so dangerous.
Of course they're dangerous. That's the point. What do you want me to do, go in there with a hunk of rolled-up newspaper? She was still giving that one some thought when we reached the second floor. I took out the automatic and eased the safety off, pulling back the slide on the barrel to cock it. I slipped the key to Elaine's lock, and then I opened the door and let it swing back. Tilly was holding on to my sleeve like a little kid. I waited a moment, staring into the gloomy interior with my heart thumping. There was no sound, no movement inside. I felt for the light switch and flipped it on, peering around the door frame quickly. Nothing. I indicated that Tilly was to wait where she was, and I moved through the apartment, quietly, turning lights as I went, using a modified version of my best junior G-man stance every time I entered a room. As far as I could tell, there was no sign that anyone had been there. I checked the closets and took a quick peek under the bed, and then sighed, realizing that I'd been holding my breath. I went back to the front door and had Tilly come in, closing and locking it behind us. I moved back down the hallway to the den. I went through Elaine's desk quickly, checking her files. In the third drawer down, I found her passport and flipped through the pages. It was still valid, but it hadn't been used since a trip to Cozumel 1 April 3 years back. I tucked the passport in my back pocket. If she was still around, I didn't want her using her passport to slip out of the country. There was something else knocking around in the back of my head, but I couldn't figure out what it was. I shrugged to myself, assuming it would surface in due course. I deposited Tilly at her door. Look, I said, when you have a chance, take a careful look around and see if anything's missing. When you go down to the police station, they'll want a list of stolen property if you know of any. Do you carry any homeowner's insurance that might cover the damages?
I don't know, she said. I guess I can check. Would you like some tea?
Her expression was wistful, and she clung to my hand. Tilly, I wish I could, but I've got to go. I know you're uneasy, but you'll be okay. Is there somebody in the building who can keep you company?
Maybe the woman in apartment 6. I know she's up early. I'll try her. And thanks, Kinsey. I mean that.
Don't worry about it. I was glad to help. I'll talk to you later. Get some sleep if you can. I left her, looking after me plaintively as I headed toward the lobby. I got in the car and tucked the gun in the glove compartment again, and then I headed for my place. My head was full of questions, but I was too tired to think. By the time I crept back in the folds of my quilt, the sky was a pre-dawn gray, and an enterprising rooster somewhere in my neighborhood was heralding the day. The phone shrilled again at 8 o'clock a.m. I just reached that wonderful heavy stage of sleep where your nervous system turns to lead, and you feel like some kind of magnetic force has just fused you to the bed. Consistently waking someone from a sleep like that could generate psychosis in 2 days. What? I mumbled. I could hear static in the line, but nothing else. Oh, goody, maybe I'd been wakened by a long-distance obscene phone caller. Hello?
Oh, that's you. I thought I'd dialed the number wrong. This is Julia Oxner down in Florida. Did I wake you up?
Don't worry about it, I said. I thought I just saw you. What's happening?
I've come across some information I thought you might like to have. It looks like that woman next door was telling the truth when she told you Elaine flew down here in January, at least as far as Miami.
Really? I said, sitting up. What makes you say that?
I found the plane ticket in the garbage, she said with satisfaction. You'll never believe what I did. She was packing up to go, and she'd set several boxes full of discards and trash out. I'd been down to the manager's apartment, and on my way back I spotted the ticket. It was right near the top, shoved down half out of sight, and I wanted to see whose it was. I didn't think I could come right out and ask her, so I waited until she made a trip down to the parking lot with a load of clothes, and I just scampered out there and stole it.
You scampered? I said with disbelief.
Well, it wasn't scampering, exactly. More like a fast creep. I don't think she even missed it.
Julia, what made you do that? Suppose she'd caught you.
What do I care? I'm having a ball. When I got back, I had to go lie down. I was laughing so hard.
Yeah, well, you'll never guess what's happened here, I said. I got fired.
Fired?
More or less. Elaine's sister told me to lay off for the time being. She got nervous when I told her I thought we should file a missing persons report with the cops.
I don't understand. Why would she object?
Beats me. When did Elaine leave Santa Teresa? Do you have the date?
It looks like January 9th. The return was left open.
Well, that helps some. Why don't you drop that in the mail to me if it's not too much trouble? Beverly may back down yet.
But that's ridiculous. What if Elaine's in trouble?
What can I do? I'm paid to follow instructions. I can't just bop around doing anything I please.
What if I hired you myself?
I hesitated, taken aback by the idea, but not opposed to it. I don't know. That could get sticky. I suppose I could terminate my relationship with her, but there's no way I could release information to you that I'd uncovered for her. You and I would have to start from scratch.
But she couldn't prevent me from hiring you, could she? I mean, once you've settled your account with her?
God, it's too early in the morning for me to worry about this stuff. But I'll mull it over and see what I can come up with. As far as I know, I could turn around and work for you as long as it doesn't represent any conflict of interest. I'd have to advise her what's going on, but I don't see how she could interfere.
Good. Then do it.
Are you sure you want to spend your money that way?
Of course I am. I have lots of it, and I want to know what's happened to Elaine. Besides, I'm having the time of my life. Just tell me what we do next.
All right. Let me nose around some, and I'll call you back. And Julia, in the meantime, would you watch out for yourself? I said, but she just laughed. Chapter 6. I stayed in the shower until the hot water ran out, and then I got dressed, pulling on jeans and a cotton sweater, zipping boots up to my knees. I plopped on a soft leather hat with a wide brim and studied the effect in the bathroom mirror. It would do. I headed for the office first and wrote a letter to Beverly Danziger, terminating our professional relationship. I was pretty sure she'd be thoroughly disconcerted by that, and it gave me a nice feeling. I went next door to the offices of California Fidelity Insurance and made a photocopy of my itemized bill to her, marked it final, and tucked it in with the letter and a copy of my final report. Then I headed over to the police station on Floresta and talked to a Sergeant Jonah Robb about a missing persons report on Elaine Bolt, watching his fingers fly across the keys as he typed the information I gave him on the form.
He looked like he was in his late 30s, his body compact in his uniform. He was maybe 20 pounds overweight. Not an unattractive amount, but something he'd have to cope with soon. Dark hair trimmed very short, smooth, rounded face, a dent in his left ring finger where he'd recently worn a wedding ring. He shot a look at me at that point, blue eyes flecked with green.
"Anything you want to add to this?"
Her next-door neighbor down in Florida is sending me a plane ticket she apparently used. I'll take a look at it and see if it tells us anything else. A friend of hers named Pat Usher swears up and down she spent a couple of days with Elaine Bolt before she went off to Sarasota. But I don't believe much of what she says.
She'll probably show up. They usually do.
He took a file folder out and inserted a clamp.
You used to be a cop, didn't you?
Briefly, I said. But I couldn't make it work. Too rebellious, I guess. What about you? How long have you been on the force?
8 years. I was a detail man before that. Sold drugs for Smith, Kline, and French. I got tired of driving around in a late-model car, hitting up on doctors. It was all hype, anyway. Just like selling anything else. Sickness is big business.
He looked down at his hands, then back at me.
Well, anyway, I hope you find your lady. We'll do what we can.
Thanks, I said. I'll give you a call later in the week. I picked up my bag and moved toward the door.
Hey, he said. I looked back. I like that hat.
I smiled. As I passed the front counter on my way out, I caught sight of Lieutenant Dolan in Identification and Records, talking to a young black clerk in uniform. His glance slid past me and then came back with a look of recognition. He broke off his conversation with her and dambled over to the counter. Lieutenant Dolan is in his 50s, with a square, baggy face and a bald spot he tries to disguise with tricky arrangements of what hair remains. It's the only evidence of any vanity on his part, and it cheers me up somehow. I imagine him standing in front of his bathroom mirror every morning trying to cope with the creeping expanse of naked scalp. He was wearing rimless bifocals, apparently new, because he couldn't quite get me in range. He peered at me first from above the little half-moons, and then from below. Finally, he slipped the glasses off and tucked them in the pocket of his rumpled gray suit.
"Hello, Kinsey. I haven't seen you since the shooting. How are you doing with that?"
I felt myself flush with discomfort. I'd killed someone in the course of an investigation 2 weeks before, and I was studiously avoiding the subject. The moment he mentioned it, I realized how completely I'd willed it away. It hadn't even crossed my mind, and his reference to it seemed as startling as that dream where you find yourself stark naked in a public place. "I'm fine," I said briefly, breaking off eye contact. In a flash, I saw the beach at night, that slat of light when the big trash bin I was hiding in was opened, and I looked up. My little semi-automatic had jumped in my hand like some kind of reflex test, and I'd squeezed off more rounds than were really necessary for getting the job done. The blast in that confined space had been deafening, and my ears had been ringing ever since, a high-pitched hiss like gas escaping from a faulty valve. In a flash, the image was gone again, and Lieutenant Dolan was standing there, maybe wishing he'd kept his mouth shut, judging from the look on his face. My relationship to Con Dolan has always been adversarial, remote, based on a grudging mutual respect. He doesn't like private investigators as a rule. He feels we should mind our own business, whatever that is, and leave law enforcement to professionals like him. My fantasy has always been that one day we'll sit down and exchange criminal gossip like little old ladies. But now that he'd introduced a personal note, I could feel myself withdraw, disconcerted by the shift. When I met his eyes again, his gaze was flat, his expression bland. I shook my head. "Sorry," I said. "You took me by surprise. I guess I haven't quite sorted it through." Actually, what took me by surprise was realizing I'd killed someone and didn't much care. No, that wasn't true. I did care. But if my life was threatened, I knew I'd do it again. I'd always believed I was a good person.
Now I didn't know what good meant. Surely good people didn't kill other human beings. So where did that put me?
He said, "What are you doing down here?"
I shook my head again slightly and focused on the subject at hand. "I just filed a missing persons report for a client," I said. I hesitated, wondering if he'd encountered Elaine during his investigation of the incident next door. "Did you handle the Grice homicide back in January of this year?" He stared at me, his face closing up like sea anemone. Apparently he had.
"What about it?"
"I wondered if you interviewed a woman named Elaine Bolt. She lives in the condominium next door."
"I remember the name," he said carefully. "I spoke to her myself by phone. She was supposed to come down and talk to us, but I don't think she ever showed up. She your client?"
"She's the one I'm looking for."
"How long's she been gone?"
I detailed the information I had, and I could see him run through the possibilities in the same way I had. In Santa Teresa County, some 4,000 persons, male and female, are reported missing every year. Most are found again, but a few remain somewhere out in the ether. He shoved his hands down in his pockets, rocking on his heels.
"When she does turn up, tell her I want her down here for an interview," he said.
I was startled. "That case hasn't been wrapped up yet?"
"No, and I won't discuss it with you either. Department policy," he said, his favorite phrase.
"Jesus, Lieutenant Dolan, big deal. Who asked you?" I knew he was protecting the integrity of his case, but I get tired of his being such a tight ass. He thinks he is entitled to any information I have, while he never gives me a thing. I was hot, and he knew it. He smiled at me.
"I just thought I'd head off that tendency of yours to stick your nose where it doesn't belong."
"I'll help you out sometime, too," I said. "And meanwhile, if you want to talk to Elaine Bolt, you can find her yourself." I pushed away from the counter, heading toward the exit.
"Well, you don't need to take that attitude," he called.
I glanced back. He was looking entirely too self-satisfied for my taste. "Right," I said, and pushed on out the double doors. I came out of the police station into the flat, overcast day, and stood for a moment collecting myself. The man gets to me, no doubt about it. I took a deep breath. The temperature was in the mid-60s. Pale remnants of sunlight shone through the clouds, tinting the neighborhood with lemon-colored light. The shrubbery had taken on a chartreuse glow, and the grass seemed dry and artificial from the lack of moisture. It hadn't rained for weeks, and the month of June had been a monotonous succession of foggy mornings, hazy afternoons, and chilly nights. Actually, Lieutenant Dolan had opened up a possibility, and I wondered if Elaine's departure was coincidental with the murder of Marty Grice, or connected in some way. If the vandalism at Tilly's was related, why not this? Could she have taken off to avoid the lieutenant's questioning? I thought it might help to pin down some dates. I headed over to the newspaper office 6 blocks away and asked the clerk in the newspaper morgue to track down the file clips on Marty Grice's death. There was only one clip, a small article, maybe 2 inches long, stuck back on page 8 of local news, dated January 4. "Burglar kills housewife, then burns body, police say." A Santa Teresa housewife was bludgeoned to death during an apparent burglary in her West Side residence early last night. According to homicide detectives, Martha Renee Grice, 45, of 2095 Via Madrina, was struck repeatedly with a blunt instrument and doused with flammable liquid. The victim's body was discovered, badly burned in the foyer of the partially destroyed single-family dwelling, after Santa Teresa firefighters battled the blaze for 30 minutes. The fire was first spotted by neighbors at 9:55 p.m. Two adjacent homes were evacuated, but no other injuries were reported. Details of the arson were withheld pending further investigation. The crime seemed pretty spectacular to get such small play.
Maybe the cops hadn't had much to go on and had tried to minimize the coverage. That might explain Dolan's attitude. Maybe he wasn't being uncooperative. Maybe he had no evidence. Nothing makes a cop any tighter than that. I took down the pertinent information in my notebook, and then I walked over to the public library and checked the Santa Teresa City directory that had come out last spring. Martha Grice was listed at 2095 Via Madrina, along with a Leonard Grice, building contractor. I assumed he was the husband. The newspaper account had made no mention of him, and I wondered where he'd been when the whole thing went down. The directory listed the neighbors next door at 2093 as Oris and May Snyder. His occupation was retired, but the directory didn't say from what. I jotted down the names and the telephone number. It might be interesting to see if I could find what went on, and whether Elaine might have seen something she didn't want to talk about. The more I thought about it, the better I liked that idea. It gave me a whole new line to pursue. I retrieved my car from the lot behind my office and circled back around to Via Madrina. It was now 12 o'clock straight up, and high school students were spilling out onto the streets, girls in jeans, short white socks and high heels, guys in chinos and flannel shirts. The wholesome California sorts outnumbered the punkers about 3 to 1, but most of them looked like they'd been dressed out of rag bags. Some kids were wearing outrageous designer jumpsuits, and some wore whole outfits in camouflage fabric as though prepared for an air attack. About half the girls sported 3 to 4 earrings per ear. In hairstyles, they seemed to fancy the wet look, or ponytails sticking up out of the sides of their heads like waterspouts. As I pulled up in front of the condominium, a cluster of 6 girls were clumping down the sidewalk, smoking clove-scented cigarettes. Shoulder pads and green nail polish, dark red lipstick. They looked like they were on their way to a USO dance in 1943. I caught just a fragment of their conversation.
"So I'm all, 'What the fuck did you think I was talking about, dickhead?' And he goes like, 'Hey, well, I never did anything to you, bitch, so I don't know what your problem is.'"
I smiled to myself and then looked over at the Grice house with interest. It was white frame, a story and a half, with a squat L-shaped porch across the front, resting on fat red brick pillars topped with short pyramids of wood. It looked as if it had been jacked up somehow and might at any moment collapse. Most of the porch roof had burned away. The yard was scrappy, and a row of pale pink and blue hydrangea bushes crowded the porch, still looking browned and wilted from the fire, though new growth was bravely showing through. The front window frames on the first floor were capped with lintels of black soot where the fire had licked the framing. A sign had been posted warning trespassers away. I wondered if the salvage crew had already gone in to clean up. I was hoping not, but I was probably out of luck on that. I wanted to see the house as it had been on the night of the fire. I also wanted to chat with Leonard Grice, but there was no indication whatever that the house was inhabited. Even from the street, I could still pick up the 6-month-old cologne of charred wood and grinding damp where the firemen's hoses had penetrated every seam and crevice. As I headed toward Elaine's condominium, I spotted someone coming out of a small wooden utility shed in the Grice's backyard. I paused to watch. A kid, maybe 17. He had a mohawk haircut, 3 inches of what looked like bright pink hay, with a path mown on either side. He had his head down, his hands shoved into the pockets of his army fatigues. With a start, I realized I'd seen him before, from Elaine's front window the first time I searched her place. He'd been standing in the street below, rolling a joint at a leisurely pace. Now what was he up to? I veered, picking up my pace so my path would intersect his just about at the property line. "Hello," I said. He looked up at me, startled, flashing the sort of polite smile kids reserve for adults.
"Hi."
His face didn't match the rest of him. His eyes were deep-set, a jade green set off by dark lashes and dark eyebrows that feathered together at the bridge of his nose. His skin was clear, his smile engaging, slightly snaggle-toothed. He had a dimple in his left cheek. He glanced to one side, moving past me. I reached out and caught him by the sleeve. "Can I talk to you?" He looked at me and then quickly back over his shoulder.
"You talking to me?"
"Yes. I saw you coming out of that shed back there. You live around here?"
"What?" "Oh, sure. Couple of blocks away. This is my Uncle Leonard's house. I'm supposed to check and make sure nobody's bothering his stuff."
His voice was light, almost feminine.
"What stuff is that?"
The jade green eyes had settled on me with curiosity. He smiled and his whole face brightened.
"You a cop or something?"
"Private investigator," I said. "My name is Kinsey Milhone."
"Wow, that's great," he said. "I'm Mike. You guarding the place or something like that?"
I shook my head. "I'm looking into another matter, but I heard about the fire. Your aunt was the one who was killed?" The smile flickered.
"Yeah, right. Jesus, that was terrible. I mean, her and me were never close, but my uncle really got messed up over that. He's a fucking basket case."
"Oh, sorry about that," he said sheepishly.
"He's like vegged out or something, staying with this other aunt of mine."
"Can you tell me how to get in touch with him?"
"Well, my aunt's name is Lily Howe. I don't remember the number offhand, or I'd help you out."
He was beginning to blush, and the effect was odd. Pink hair, green eyes, rosy cheeks, green army fatigues. He looked like a birthday cake, innocent and festive somehow. He ran a hand across his hair, which was standing straight up on top like a whisk broom. I wondered why he was so ill at ease.
"What were you doing back there?"
He glanced back at the shed with an embarrassed shrug.
"I was checking the padlock. I get, like, really paranoid, you know? I mean, the guy pays me $10 a month, and I like to do right by him. Did you want something else? Because I have to grab some lunch and get back to class, okay?"
"Sure, maybe I'll see you later."
"Right, that'd be great, any time."
He smiled at me again, and then moved away, walking backward at first, his eyes latched to mine, turning finally so that I was watching the narrow back and slim hips. There was something disturbing about him, but I couldn't think what it was. Something didn't jibe. That goody-two-shoes helpfulness and the look in his eyes. Artless and cunning. A kid whose conscience is clear because he doesn't have one.